You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 265 of the Fabulous Peltoncast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are back in separate locations this week. No worries. Everything is fine. But just that the Clippers Jazz game ran late. So I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Peltoncast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
One thing I noticed is you get to say that all the time now when we do it, when we record it over Zoom, whereas I say that when we're in person. So,
oh man,
I guess we're sharing custody of home of the Seahawks.
Well, the good news is the pauses are back, baby.
Oh, they're going to be better than ever, I'm sure, this week.
I actually was listening to a podcast this week, not the Pelton cast, if you can believe it. I was listening to a podcast this week and I experienced a pause long enough that I looked at my phone to see if somebody was calling or something.
I mean, it's definitely, it happens. They're out there. They're just maybe not as frequent as on the Peltoncast.
I empathize.
they're out there in the wild.
They're out there.
So we are not, we were going to drink a split of beer, but since we're not together, instead we are not going to do that. I'm drinking a Rainier this week, going back to the old classic.
There we go. And I'm drinking San Juan Seltzer, which I think is my new old classic.
I don't think that works. I don't think that's how that works. Not that San Juan Seltzer is not great. You just can't be a new old classic.
Oh, the like 30-pack Peach Rosé Dry Rosé at Costco. Undefeated.
I was hoping that was going to be a sufficiently long pause to be awkward. All right, some toast to get through this week. We start with Jewel Lloyd.
Did you say to get to or to get through?
To get to.
Okay.
What's the slog here? Toasting things.
Yeah, this isn't the OL Rain section. This isn't you talking about the Sounders, God.
Did we do the OL Rain section this week? Jewel Lloyd named Western Conference Player of the Week by the WNBA after averaging 22.7 points and 4.7 assists per game as the Storm went 2-1 last week, including Lloyd hitting the second game-winning buzzer beater of her career on Friday to beat the Dallas Wings.
Hello.
Talk about that a little more in the Storm section. The Storm have now won the Western Conference Player of the Week 2 of 3 weeks thus far, with Brianna Stewart also doing so in the first extended week of the season.
Huge.
Some honors for UW softball. Gabby Plain was named first team All-American by the NFCA, while Sis Bates and Bailey Klingler both earned second team All-America honors. Now, Oklahoma, shockingly, they lost their first game in the Women's College World Series to James Madison. They fought their way back out of the
losers.
James Madison.
They've only lost two games all year previously, right?
Correct.
Like, they were inspired. I heard this many times in the broadcast. They were inspired because they went to Georgia and lost a game. And that's how they put the whole season together. And then I think they also lost to Oklahoma State. And then they lost to James Madison in the first game of the Women's College World Series.
It's been a miraculous run for James Madison. Now, sadly, Oklahoma did beat them in the rematch, beat them twice in the semifinal to knock them out of the tournament. But still an incredible, impressive run there.
Oklahoma's still alive.
They also beat UCLA in the loser's bracket, knocked out the number 2 seed UCLA, which had lost their second game, I believe. Now they reached the Women's College World Series final against Florida State, but lost game one earlier tonight, 8-4.
I was going to say, I kept seeing Florida State versus Texas A&M. Is that who it was?
I don't think Texas A&M is in it, but
I thought that Oklahoma was eliminated.
They were not. They were not. But right. One loss away now from being eliminated. So much for the greatest college softball team of all time.
Yeah, take that.
Maybe not the greatest college softball team of 2021.
I don't know why we're happy about this. They kind of crushed the Huskies.
Right. I did not know what to think during that Oklahoma-UCLA game, which UCLA led early. Rachel Garcia had a 3-run homer, but Oklahoma just too much hitting late in that game. Won that like 8-3.
UCLA's no James Madison. They might be good at softball. I just assume that they're probably not.
Well, they were unseeded. I mean, it was a surprising win. They had only lost twice as well, but not the same competition that Oklahoma was facing. Exciting news this week. This is a huge toast.
Oh, my God.
The Columbia Cup is back on the schedule.
Wow.
We had missed this announcement, but with Washington Governor Jay Inslee announcing plans to fully reopen the state and lift COVID-related restrictions on June 30th, the Tri-City Waterfall has announced plans for a smaller scale event this year with limited attendance. I think they said around 9,000 people on each side of the river. So we're going to have to jump on those tickets early is what I'm saying here.
Are we? I was going to say, are we going to have to change our entire schedule for the summer? Everything that we have planned has changed now because the fucking waterfall is back.
It is actually horrible timing this year because it's going to go up probably against the start of NBA free agency or lead into that. And like it's around the draft. And normally these are not things I have to worry about at the end of July. But
what about
for
Seafair?
Me personally,
is Seafair off?
Seafair has not announced any plans to change, go back to an actual in-person event. So I don't think so. All right, next up this week, we're toasting to Pelton Cast legend Nikola Jokic for winning MVP. As third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin pointed out on Twitter, the second greatest honor he's ever received after being one of my 10 players to watch for the 2015-16 NBA season when he debuted with the Denver Nuggets, when I had this to say about him.
Last year, I know on the list was Yusuf Nurkic.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Nuggets.
Yeah, that was the first time that I'd ever heard of Yusuf Nurkic. And it was a great year for him.
It was
a great Nurkic year.
A breakout year, really. Nurkic was one of the Nuggets' first-round picks 2 years ago. Mm. In the second round, they took another guy from the former Yugoslavia.
Another Nurkic?
He is not a Nurkic. He's not a Nurkic, but another talented player who my stats liked.
Who is that?
Named Nikola Jokic.
That's another Nurkic.
Okay. It is another Nurkic.
Nikola Jokic?
He's a different player. So he's like a face-up power forward.
I've never heard of this person.
He's got NBA three-point range. He's 6'10". He's got three-point range. Good passer. Was really outstanding during the preseason. He had the most wins above replacement player by my system of any rookie during the preseason, just ahead of Karl Towns,
the
number one pick.
How much does the preseason matter?
A little bit.
It does matter. It's,
and especially
it's an important
for rookies.
Predictive factor.
There's some signal there.
Okay, say this person's name again.
Nikola Jokic.
How do you spell that?
J-O-K-I-C.
Okay.
So if he gets good, expect like Jokic face. That's going to be a thing. Like
Jokic face?
Joker face.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my prediction. That's a bonus prediction.
The Jokic face?
It's a very specific prediction.
Okay.
All right, next
I'm
up.
I'm excited about the Jokic-Nurkic combo.
I don't.
Well, at least you were wrong about one of the things there.
Yeah, that I looked it up. That did not become a thing.
You shared your files on your computer and you have multiple Jokic files and a file that is called Victory Lap. And somehow this wasn't the Victory Lap.
Oh, the Victory Lap. You know what that is. That's the Sue Bird from last year.
Oh, God.
You know,
how many freaking files do you have saved just to throw things in my face?
Well, this wasn't throwing anything in your face.
I seemed generally pro Jokic. It's funny because hearing it now in hindsight and knowing who Jokic is, it seems ridiculous to be like, who is this person? How do you spell their name? But like, Jokic wasn't a known commodity at that time.
He was the 41st pick. Yeah, like, no, he wasn't a known commodity. So, but it all started, the MVP campaign, it all started right here on the Pelton Cast.
There we go. I'm happy that I was pro Nurkic at the time.
Yeah, also our love for Yusuf Nurkic, which, by the way, the other clip included us talking about that riot cop story. So multiple times on the podcast, Yusuf Nurkic's dad being a riot cop has come up.
We didn't talk about that. That was offline that we talked about.
Oh, that was offline. We talked about it recently. Yeah. I'm disappointed to learn that an unrecorded podcast, as you like to call it.
I like to call it. Well, anyway, congrats on being early on Jokic and to your stats again.
All right, our last toast this week is to Seattle's newest team, the Kraken, for securing the number 2 pick in their inaugural draft in last week's draft lottery. And since we have no ability to contextualize this news, we're bringing in someone who can help us do it. My friend from The Athletic Seattle, back to cover the Kraken here, Ryan S. Clark, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's good to see you both.
Yeah, so like I said, we're just going to ask the simplest questions possible and hope that you can explain them to us, because interested in hockey, but just not a lot of understanding of it. So how much does it mean to get the number 2 pick? You know, what is the relative value of the top picks? You know, what kind of descending value is there over the round in the NHL draft?
Sure. Well, I mean, when you look at the number two pick, it's a big deal because you think about some of the players that have gone number two that have had success. Jack Eichel in Buffalo, even though the Sabres have struggled, like he is a name that people immediately recognize. Victor Hedman is another player who went number two behind John Tavares in his draft year. And so when you have the number two pick, I mean, yes, it's one of those things where there's a reason why whoever went number one went number one, but getting the number two pick, it's not like this is a horrible consolation, but furthermore, like number two picks generally become players who are not only productive players, but like they are central to what you do. And so like, if you are the Seattle Kraken, you're looking at the number two pick and it seems like there's a lot of different directions you can go. There isn't really a true number one consensus player, but the thought is maybe that's Michigan defenseman Owen Power because he's 6'6", 218, can skate and do a variety of different things. But when you look at who's next, there is going to be options. The Kraken can go with a forward and different types of forward, whether it's someone who's more of a scorer, someone who's more of a two-way player. They could go with a defenseman, which there are a couple names out there. So they're going to have options. But yes, it is a big deal, especially when you look at the fact that the Vegas Golden Knights, they picked sixth in the expansion. Well, they picked sixth in their expansion year. The Kraken get number two. So no, it's monumental for any franchise, let alone an expansion franchise.
Huge. Okay, so Ryan, tell us, what is icing? No. Curious to have you mention that it is looking at somebody who could be a franchise type player. Curious though, if you were to assemble a hockey team, you know, when you look at football, right, you start with, you need a quarterback first. In basketball, you probably want a wing type player, somebody like that. Is there a position in hockey that is considered more valuable than any other position? Because I'm surprised to hear you say that a defenseman could go number one.
It all depends upon your team. And so like, there are people who say they want a center because the center controls so much, whether it be face-offs, scoring goals, creating for themselves, creating for others, dictating the tempo. And right now there's a phrase, a term, 200-foot player, which means someone who they play the entire length of the ice. And like, you can find that in a center, but at the same time, when you look at the impact a defenseman can have, like it can make everyone around them better. And not only that, but there is a thought in the NHL that like, look, it is in some ways easier to fill out a roster of forwards than it can be six reliable defensemen, which is why a lot of teams are happy to get four, maybe five, let alone six. And so to like what you're saying about like defensemen, it's this. So like you think about someone like Owen Power, let's say he ends up going to the Buffalo Sabres, the team that again has had their issues over the last few years. You suddenly have a defense with him and Rasmus Dahlin. And Dahlin is someone that when he was drafted was the consensus number one pick. This is a player that people are like, he could be a future Norris Trophy winner. Maybe win a couple, at least two Norris Trophies before it's all said and done. And all of a sudden you have someone like Owen Power, which to think about that, it's interesting because when you look at some of the teams in the NHL right now, like let's take the Colorado Avalanche. Part of their strength, even though they have a Nathan MacKinnon and a Mikko Rantanen, is they invested early on defense, which you saw them get Cale Makar, Connor Timmins. They trade Matt Duchene, and that turns into Samuel Girard, Bowen Byram. They pick up Ryan Graves. All of a sudden, you've got a defense that a lot of teams would covet. The New York Rangers are the same way with Adam Fox, Keandre Miller. Yes, they bring in Jacob Trouba, who's slightly older, but the thing is this, whether it's them, the Hurricanes, you look at the Lightning, there's a strength to building around defense.
I was going to ask about Carolina and sort of how much we can glean about Ron Francis's views about how to build a team from his time there.
Well, you look at his draft record, 27 of the 33 players Ron Francis drafted in his 4 years in Carolina either are with the Hurricanes organization or they signed an NHL contract elsewhere. So that's a really high percentage. And when you look at how Francis built those teams, like he was part of the front office before he became the general manager. So like he was able to see firsthand the importance of being able to hit for value in those later rounds. So you think about players like Jacob Slavin, you think about players like Brent Pesce, like they're part of that core there in Carolina. And then it is about being able to make sure that you can hit on those first rounders. And so like if you're Francis, this is a little bit of an interesting dynamic because Kraken ownership has made it clear that they are willing to spend money. I mean, you look at the fact they're putting $1 billion into an arena, more than $90 million into a training facility. Clearly there's a willingness to spend. And so if you can find a way to use that sort of resource and take advantage of those resources and combine it with someone who, when he was in Carolina, maybe didn't have access to all those resources. The thought is maybe they could do something there. But when you look at how Francis approached the draft, his teams were very, very, very strong when it came to not only hitting on first round picks for the most part, but finding value in rounds 2 through 7, which when you look at certain teams, like let's say the Tampa Bay Lightning, yes, they have Steven Stamkos and Andre Vasilevsky and Victor Hedman and Nikita Kucherov and Braden Point. But like their strength has been, can they get guys from the second round on? Can they find those undrafted free agents who turn into successes? So whether that's Kucherov, Andre Palat, Tyler Johnson, Anthony Cirelli, the list goes on. Braden Point, the list goes on and on. That's where the strength is, and that's what the Kraken are hoping to emulate.
The other draft-related question I was curious about, like I don't have great context for this, and it seems like from reading your story about the Kraken building out a minor league system and what they're planning to do next year before their AHL affiliate comes online, is that it can vary depending on what type of player you draft. But when are we expecting to see this number two pick in Seattle, and when are we expecting to see them become a contributor?
It all depends upon the player because everyone's development is different. So let's say if it's kind of maybe the course of the typical number two pick, maybe later in year one, but possibly more in year two. So let's take last year's number two pick, Quentin Byfield. So Byfield was drafted by the LA Kings, and he was someone who spent the year playing in the AHL because under regular circumstances, he would have been back in the OHL after the NHL. Let me start it from the beginning, because I don't want to make this too wordy, but it's kind of complicated. So the way it works in the NHL is if you are someone who plays major junior, so like the league that the Everett Silvertips and the Seattle Thunderbirds play in, so the WHL, the OHL, and the QMJHL, the rules are this. You can play for an NHL team, but they have up to 9 games to play you. And then they have to determine, do they want to activate the first year of your entry-level contract, or do they want to send you down? And if they send you down, you have to spend the rest of the league with your junior team. You can't go to the AHL. And so with this year being such a difficult one because of COVID-19, players in the Ontario Hockey League, there was no OHL season. So Quentin Byfield went to the AHL where he's playing professionally. He spends that year and the Kings bring him up at the end of the year and we're able to get a glimpse for how he could factor in. So next year, the thought is, could he end up being their number two center behind Andre Kopitar? And that way, when you look at what they have, line one is being centered by someone who's 6'3", 220, a legitimate Selke candidate, someone who is probably going to go into the Hall of Fame and a captain who has led teams to the Stanley Cup. And then behind him, he is mentoring 6'4", probably going to be 215, 220 with all the athleticism and the ability in the world. So I hope that makes sense.
I just love hearing you talk about hockey players that I've never heard of and awards.
Yeah, no, it's like your big smile. And part of me is just like, I hope this is because
No. It's just
like, Jesus, people care this much about hockey.
I think you might have said that somebody was going to win a Selke Award.
Selke
Award. Got Norse Awards. And so it's huge. It's all of it is brand new.
Norse Award? This is awesome.
I'm more familiar with the Norris division and references to the NFC Central at that point as the Norris division from Chris Berman. I feel like that's my background there.
If this number two pick, well, just a question about where they would play. Sure. Is that something where one of the junior league teams or a WHL team or somebody like that, do they get the rights or is it the NHL team is assigning them to a certain squad?
So the NHL team works with whoever their parent club is. So in some cases, it could be – let's just use some examples. So let's say they draft Matthew Beniers, the center out of the University of Michigan. So in order for Matthew Beniers to attain and keep his college eligibility, he can't sign a contract with the Kraken. But his draft rights do belong to the Kraken. So that means they can talk to the University of Michigan about, okay, what is the best way to develop him? And they can say to Michigan, okay, we want to see him play on, you know, these certain situations. So like let's say – we want to see him on the PK, penalty kill, the power play, whatever. Beniers already does that, but like with an NHL team, they work with those collegiate coaches to sort of figure out what is the best model of development. If it's a junior player, they can go ahead and sign a contract. It just, again, it depends on how many NHL games they play before that first year is activated. And it's the same thing. Like, they can send that player down to juniors. They can hold on to him for as long as they need you before that 10-game threshold. And when they go back down to junior, it's working with the junior coach. Now, with you're drafting a player who's based in Europe, this is where it gets a little bit complicated because, one, there are teams that have development coaches that travel all over North America and Europe. And so, like, if you're working with a European player, it depends on where you draft them because some guys want to come over immediately. Some guys want to stay. In the case of Russian players, those players usually stay at least 2 years before coming over to the U.S., maybe three or four in some cases. And so, again, every situation is different, but either way, if a team has your draft rights, the understanding is they're going to play a pivotal role in seeing how you develop, and they're going to work with your parent club to make sure that you all get to the same goal. Because, like, here's the thing. For the parent club, it benefits them because you have one kid who has success. What's going to stop teams from saying, why not go there again? So, like, here's a short story. You take Cale Makar when he was at the University of Massachusetts. He's drafted fourth by the Avalanche. He goes to UMass. The Avs are like, you know, we think you're ready after year one. Cale's like, no, I want to give it another year. So he stays at UMass for a second year. The relationship the Avalanche build with the head coaching staff at UMass is so strong to the point the Avs development coach, Brett Clark, like, they would even have him sit in on practices, get his thoughts on, hey, what could we be doing better? Not just with Cale, but, like, what do you see in our practices? And it built, like, this really, really good relationship. And when you look at it now, so if the Avalanche have another kid that they draft who's going to UMass, they know what to expect. Those stories get out. It makes other teams throughout the league trust what's going on. And so, like, that's what makes these relationships so vital. I apologize if that was too long of an answer.
Sam Hinkie is very excited about the chance to draft a Russian player and not have them come over for 2 years. With a college player, can you go back into the draft, or does the team that drafts you initially just kind of maintain your rights until you're ready to turn pro?
If you're a college player, the team who has your rights can hold on to them until the window expires. So if you're a college player, it's a 4-year window. And at the end of that window, if you don't get signed, then any other team can grab you. If you are a major junior player, depending upon your birth year, I believe it is, if you don't have your rights obtained by a team, you can re-enter the draft. And so, like, what you've seen in some cases, like, for example, Connor Brickley was a player who was the first pick by the Avalanche, and believe it was like 2014. He didn't agree to terms with the Avs. A few years later, he was drafted in the later rounds by the St. Louis Blues. So, like, there's a precedent for that. And there's also a precedent for, usually players get drafted in their year 17, 18 season, but there have been cases where they don't. But if you're playing well enough, a team can come back and draft you in what's considered your overage year.
Well, moving past the draft, I mean, the other thing that we have on the horizon with the Kraken is the hiring of their first head coach, and we're a month and a half away from the expansion draft and then the amateur draft as we talk about this. How far before that do you feel like the Kraken need to have a coach in place to figure out what kind of system they're building for?
Sure. Well, Ron Francis has said, and he stuck to this, that they see them possibly trying to make a hire by the end of the second quarter, so the end of this month. As for how far along they are, there's a reason he has the nickname Fort Knox Francis. He's like, yeah, we're on the back nine, but he doesn't say if that's whole 10, that's whole 18 or where they're at. But where it gets interesting in terms of them trying to hire a coach is the thought is the movement on this could pick up really soon. And as for having a coach in place for their system, this is where it becomes a little bit of chicken or the egg, because there are people who argue having a coach in place, it allows you to figure out what you're going to be, who you're going to be, so on and so forth. But then there's the crowd that also argues too, how many times have teams drafted players knowing that, hey, their coaching situation is going to change, either because they're going to fire someone, they're going to move on from someone, or maybe someone gets a better offer somewhere else and they can't afford to keep that coach. So while having a coach is important, there is that school of thought of whoever you draft is going to be whoever you draft, regardless of whoever is your coach.
Do we think there's an element with the timing of them waiting to see whether some of these coaches that are currently in the playoffs become available, or you know, coaching changes that are made, or is that, are we far enough in the playoffs by that point, by this point, that that's not really a concern?
No, that was one of the reasons behind why they wanted to take their time, was to see who was out there, because if they wanted to make a hire, they could have. There are plenty of names available, like Gerard Gallant, Claude Julien, Bruce Boudreau. But by waiting and seeing what happens with other teams, it's allowed them to be able to say, okay, here's the landscape. So they've reportedly interviewed with Rick Tocchet, the Arizona Coyotes coach, who was let go by his team at the end of the year. David Quinn was let go by the New York Rangers. That's another name that's out there. John Tortorella was let go by the Columbus Blue Jackets. Well, that was another name who's out there as well. But what's interesting, of course, is the name that won't go away is Carolina Hurricanes coach Rod Brind'Amour. Long and short of it, there's a connection from Francis and Brind'Amour's time in Carolina. They've known each other for a long time. And plus, when you look at the Kraken, like, there is a steady stream of Carolina Hurricanes people who are making their way to the Pacific Northwest. Where it gets interesting is Don Waddell told our Sarah Sivian back in late March, they were getting close on a new deal. Tonight, Sportsnet's Elliot Friedman said during one of the intermissions of the Avalanche Golden Knights game that they are getting close to agreeing upon a contract. And one of the holdups was just making sure that Brind'Amour's assistance was taken care of. But he's like, whether or not he resigns, which at this point it's looking like he will, that is when the movement on the coaching circus will start, because people want to see what was going to happen with Rod Brind'Amour. Once Rod Brind'Amour is off the board, then you're going to possibly see activity. But if Rob Brind'Amour doesn't sign a new deal with the Hurricanes, which again, it looks like he's going to, but let's say if he doesn't, then all of a sudden it's an open market for probably the biggest coaching name there is.
Yeah. So the domino falls and then everything else kind of falls into place.
Exactly.
John Tortorella is the first name that I recognize that you've said.
In the entire thing?
I think of a player at least.
Well, he's a coach, so.
Or of a person affiliated with hockey.
You don't know Eichel? Kopitar? I feel like I know. I'm knowing a few of these names. We are really starting from the ground level on this podcast, aren't we?
We'll see. I know NHL 94 and watch the Wayne Gretzky documentary. Of the names that you're talking about, though, understanding that Rob Brind'Amour.
Rod Brind'Amour, yes.
There we go. If he's going to be off the board, and it's looking like he's going to be off the board, do you think that that means that there could be a decision relatively quickly? If the Kraken were kind of waiting him out, that they might have basically a second choice in mind?
It's hard to say, Tristan, for this reason. So the Arizona Coyotes, the New York Rangers, the Columbus Blue Jackets, the Buffalo Sabres, they're also teams that are looking for a head coach. Now, yes, the Sabres have an interim head coach in Don Granato, which they could easily say, you're our guy, but like every team, they want to do their due diligence. And so that's just the thing is, like, yes, seeing Brind'Amour's decision play out is going to offer more clarity, but then it is going to turn into a competition for who can get certain coaches. And so that's what makes this a little bit of a complicated thing, because there are so many moving parts that you really have to wait for Rod Brind'Amour before everything else sort of falls into place.
I guess, how good of a job is this job? Because the way that I would view it is, I would view it as a pretty exceptional job. You talk about the ownership group is willing to spend money. You're kind of coming in with a bit of a blank slate. There should be a pretty long runway, given that, you know, you're coming in the first season of the franchise, and also just kind of the fervor around the team. This could be a very Seattle-centric perspective, but my perspective, knowing literally nothing about the situation, would be that this would be one of the best jobs in the NHL that's out there.
So league sources have said this is going to be one of the best jobs because, like you said, it's the ownership, it's the willingness to spend money, but it's this too. You know you're going to be given time. And so right now you look at expansion teams and people are going to say, well, do you compare them to the Vegas Golden Knights? But the reality is, there's enough differences, which we'll get to here in a sec about why that is. But the point is, it's like you're going to be given time, because there have been people who said the first year of an expansion team, you're playing with house money, because if you're a fan, it's just the excitement and the novelty of we have a team, and whether they win or lose, we are just thrilled to have it. It's really year two and year three is when those expectations start to set in. But even then, what makes that so intriguing is when you look at the Golden Knights making the Stanley Cup final and getting to that point in their first year, there are people who are like, well, why can't the Kraken emulate that? Well, here's the thing. One, general managers have sworn we're not going to make the same mistakes as we did the last time. And two, the flat cap. So the long and short of it is this. The NHL every year raises its salary cap, but of course, because of COVID and revenues and fans not being allowed in the buildings until recently, the league decided, along with the PA, let's go ahead and keep the flat, like the salary cap at what it is, $81.5 million. Well, because of that, there is going to be teams who they want to keep players, but they can't afford to keep players, and they're already up against the cap. Meanwhile, you look at the Kraken, depending on how they manage the expansion draft, they could do a lot of damage by being able to take advantage of teams' financial woes, whether it be through the expansion draft, through trade, or through free agency. And so, like, if you're a coach, you think about all those things, it looks like you're going to be set up with a pretty good roster. But as for what makes this such an interesting job and one of the better jobs, according to league sources, that's why.
I think Tristan feels like Rod Brind'Amour, this would be very attractive to him.
But Rod Brind'Amour has a team that is already built, that he already knows what they are. He already knows the landscape. Like, that's just kind of the thing is, like, are you willing to walk away from that? Because, like, you look at Carolina, like, Carolina is a place where people care about that team. It's a very good team. They're young. They're built for the future. Sure, yes, they lose to the Tampa Bay Lightning, but at the same time, like, are they that far away? Now, yes, there's some things in free agency they've got to get sorted out, but at the end of the day, like, that is a very strong situation to sort of think about. So again, there's nothing that says, oh, why wouldn't he leave? There's a lot of advantages to staying with the Carolina Hurricanes, a lot.
So it's interesting because it feels like it's a little contradictory. Like, we've heard this for the last couple of years since the Kraken were approved, basically, that general managers saying, hey, we're going to learn from what happened with Vegas, where it seemed like primarily making a lot of pre-expansion draft deals to ensure that players, you know, they could choose which player was selected rather than letting Vegas just make that choice from the list as you would. But it's kind of balanced out by the aspect that you mentioned in terms of the salary cap staying flat and teams being in a tricky financial spot, that it seems like the Kraken may end up getting a similar benefit to Vegas, which was primarily financial, I think, even if teams are trying to avoid those mistakes. Is that a fair way to think about it?
No, it's an extremely fair way to think about it, just because here's what it comes back to. So you look at the Golden Knights right now. Alex Tuck, who scored tonight, he is someone that the Minnesota Wild let go because they wanted to keep a certain player. You look back at that decision now, Alex Tuck is a 6'4" power forward who can score 20 goals, have 20 assists, and be someone you can move up and down your top nine, the kind of player the Wild would love to still have. And so, like, if you are an NHL general manager, you're trying to avoid that. But when you look at things like no movement clauses, which anyone with one of those has to be protected, you look at the flat cap, like, there's going to be certain things that are out of your hands. And so it's not to say that you can't make side deals with the Kraken, but it's also one of those things where, depending on your financial situation, the leverage could be really, really, really in the Kraken's favor.
Well, this is all exciting to hear. It sounds like things are setting up very well for the Kraken, and we, you know, they've got a player now. We're making progress, and we're coming up on some exciting moments with the first coach and then the expansion draft and then making this number two pick. So excited really to have you providing great coverage of the Kraken on The Athletic, also on Twitter. Let everyone know where they can follow you.
I don't know if I want to put people through that, but if they choose to, it's at Ryan_S_Clark.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I'm a follower, but maybe not getting all of the NHL references on all of those tweets.
I mean, look, we've got a full 82 game season. We've got an off season. I mean, it takes time. Like, the thing about it is this, like, this is a game that, like, for people who've maybe never been exposed to it, you know, once you start really getting into it, it's a very, very easy game to sort of follow. I mean, like, yes, there's the rules and all this and that, but at the same time, like, there is something about hockey where people sort of understand, like, hey, for a lot of fans, like, this isn't baseball, basketball, or football in the United States where people traditionally grow up with this. Like, there might be some teaching and education. And it's why when you sit there and you look at it, it's why Vegas' fan base was able to grow as quickly as it did. It's why Tampa is one of those places where guys want to go play. So like, for all the conversations about the quickness of a traditional market and how they attach to it, like you look at the non-traditional markets, places like those two, San Jose being another one, like it's where you find some of your most devout fans and some of your most smart, well, most educated fans as well. And so, yeah, it's probably going to be the same thing here.
Yeah, I think it's just totally different when you have a team to have it be your own. So looking forward to that. And again, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Let's make this regular, Ryan.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess where we run, in all seriousness, let me ask you guys this. I mean, are there any more questions like you guys have? Because I mean, like, I know you asked like what's icing, which I mean, if you really want me to
I think
like,
I actually do know.
Oh, okay. Okay. I mean, like, I mean, seriously, like there is no such thing as like a bad question. Cause I mean, like, I understand how in a few months this whole city and region is like going to be armed for this, but I also get how there's going to be questions about it. So yeah, whatever you guys want to ask, just feel free.
That was incredible. I feel like I've like started the first day at work and they're like, okay, here's what your responsibilities will be. And then they name a bunch of words that you've never heard before. And you're like, wow, I've got a lot of shit to do here. Eventually some of this might make sense, but huh, there's a Carolina Hurricanes apparently.
Would you like me to spell the names of any of the players that came up on here? I mean, it's only like three that I can name probably, but. And I don't know, could I spell Keuchel off the top of my head? I don't know if I could get that correct either.
Like Dallas Keuchel? Is that a person?
Or it's Eichel. Yeah, Keuchel.
You don't even know.
Yeah.
You're like, I know him
but
well.
If he says the name, I can recognize it in that context.
Great. Congrats to you. No, that was awesome. I'm so excited to have Ryan back to hear more about hockey and over time, maybe even learn who some of these people are.
And we're going to have some other hockey correspondents checking in with us. You know, I think we're just going to stick to people with the initials RC is our hockey correspondents.
Wow.
So a little preview there.
There we go.
Should we turn our attention to our search for Seattle's best fried chicken? Because this was a big week for us.
Yes.
We've been anticipating this for a long time. Doing the head-to-head showdown
test
between Izell's Famous Chicken and Heaven Sent Fried Chicken. So to explain the context for this, from in terms of why there are two competitors here, Izell's Famous Chicken opened in 1984 in their classic 23rd Avenue location across from Garfield High School by Izell Stevens and Lewis Rudd, who are natives of East Texas and members of their family. Izell's quickly became a hit, but really reached a new level in 1989 when Oprah visited and called it her favorite fried chicken on air. They later flew in ingredients the next year to make chicken for Oprah's birthday. And then after a second location in the U District closed in 1994, expansion of the Izell's chain began in earnest in 1998. So later, well down the road, Stevens and Rudd had a split as business partners and agreed in a settlement to share rights to the recipe. Well, Rudd and his sister, Faye Stevens, who is Izell's ex, continue to run Izell's and have franchised it with now 15 locations in the Puget Sound area, two more, one in Spokane and Portland. Izell Stevens opened up Heaven Sent Fried Chicken, which currently has locations in Lake City and Everett after, sadly, the location in downtown Renton closed.
R.I.P.
We still miss it.
We pour one out. In awkward silence. In honor of the downtown Renton Izell's.
It didn't sound awkward enough if it was a planned memorial. So we've obviously had fried chicken from both of these places, but never at the same time in the same place. And we made that happen after the Storm game on Sunday. I was coming down from Everett, so I picked up Heaven Sent in Lake City and then had you go to the 23rd Avenue Izell's and pick that up. And then we met at Fremont Brewing. And even though it was the most miserable rainy day and it was pouring rain throughout those drives, as soon as we got in the city of Seattle and got near Fremont, the skies parted.
Oh.
Our fried chicken taste test was blessed from above with great weather.
The heavens opened for the showdown, right? They knew. My favorite part of the whole experience was when we got to Fremont Brewing. We had a giant table all to ourselves, the two of us. The person there was like, do you want a barrel or do you want a table? And it was like, that table seems pretty warm, pretty nice. So there's nobody else here at like 9 o'clock. We had this giant table to ourselves, opened up all the chicken. It's just like sprawling on the table. And the person next to us was like, where'd you get that from? And we're like, it's from Heaven Sent End, Izell's, like a damn sociopath. Like,
I'd say we should have just said Izell's. Like, it's much more convenient.
So much better. So much better to be like, hey, it's from Heaven Sent and Izell's. Are you even competing, bro? How many restaurants did you go to eat your dinner?
There's an Izell's like 15 blocks away from there. The Lake City location, I guess, is not that far from Fremont, but
15 blocks away. No, that's bullshit. There is only one Izell's, and that's the 23rd Izell's across from Garfield High School.
Well, this is
there's the Jay Moore mural right outside, John Moore mural.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's very cool. I mean, we've been aware of Izell's for a long time, but I don't remember like eating Izell's regularly until probably I was working for the Sonics, I would say. I don't know.
I mean, I feel like that, sure. You've been working for the Sonics for a long time, though.
Well, I've not been working for the Sonics for a long time, as it turns out. Unless
The team's been gone for over a decade. You make it seem like it was like recently that you picked up eating Izell's.
I'm saying I was 22.
I've only been eating at Izell's half of my life.
Izell's was open for a long period of time when we weren't going there that regularly. And they opened one of those new locations in that round of expansion in the late 90s, early 2000s, was in White Center, right next to the White Center Library where our mom was working. And I remember not liking Izell's that much at that point, probably because I was getting fried chicken and not the chicken strips, which eventually became my go-to.
We're gonna be having a little conversation.
We are. I welcome and I'm ready for that conversation. But like anytime you go to an event at Garfield, like go to a Garfield basketball game, great to hit up Izell's beforehand or afterwards and get their chicken. And then when Heaven Sent opened in downtown Renton, that definitely became a staple for a period of time.
Oh my god!
But
so good.
But then the thing that happened is, now the location nearest to you that I've gone to most frequently of Izell's is in Fairwood, and it's a franchised location. And I would say that the quality is not as consistent as it is at the flagship Izell's.
This is what I keep fucking telling you, right? If you're listening, if you get a theme from what we're talking about here, it's that expansion is unto itself probably bad.
What about NHL expansion? What about NBA expansion? Are you against those?
Diluting the talent pool.
Oh, no.
Look, I should have to drive 3 hours to go see a basketball game. Damn it. If you're not willing to drive 3 hours to go see a basketball game, you don't actually care about basketball. But no, it's just like the expansion here. If there were a small handful of Izell's locations, the quality and the general excitement of eating Izell's would be significantly higher. But when there's one location that's maybe not quite as good as another location or whatever, like you kind of have to be in the know. There's no Izell's fried chicken. There are a bunch of micro locations of varying degrees of quality.
I wouldn't say it's bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's still someplace I frequently go when I go over to your house, but it's definitely not the same experience. So it was,
I'm gonna get some Izell's tomorrow. Right now.
It was so good to have the 23rd Izell's again, and it made for an interesting comparison head-to-head against Heaven Sent. We laid them out on the table. They look basically identical. I mean, I have seen doing the research, have seen interviews where Izell says, like, people ask, did you change the recipe? And he's like, no, why would you mess with perfection?
I don't know if Izell Stevens changed the recipe, but this has been decades. It's been a very long time since the split happened, right?
It happened around 2010-ish.
Okay, so it's only been a decade or so since the split happened. But like, the Heaven Sent recipe is slightly different than the Izell's recipe. And I do think there's a different commitment to freshness, right?
I think is the difference. That's not a recipe though.
They look different though. Like the hue of the chicken strips, they're slightly redder, which lets you know that they're a little bit spicier if you're getting the spicy strips.
Yeah, we should explain. Well, first off, if you're not getting the spicy strips, anything else is just a delivery vehicle for the sauce. It was, so the order we got at both of these locations.
I don't know if I agree with that.
You don't think that there's a lack of flavor in the non-spicy strips?
You still get the juices coming out of them. We weren't eating them 100% fresh.
So we got at each of these two locations the two-piece snack, which I think we went with a breast and a wing at these two locations.
See, I didn't eat it. You ate a wing. I didn't eat a wing.
I don't know if I ate a wing, though.
They were big pieces of chicken. It might have been a breast and a thigh.
Could have been that. And then we went with the
fucking months. We can't even identify a cut of chicken.
The half pound or small spicy strip. Well, I don't know what you ate. Half pound or small spicy strips, which is, again, the classic go-to order, I think, at those two locations. And then that was so much fried chicken. There were no sides involved in this particular taste test.
The rolls, though.
Yes. Yes. Which are key to this entire
essential
thing.
Essential part of the eating.
I would say that the Heaven Sent particularly advanced the sides. I don't think that Azelle's had mac and cheese before Heaven Sent started offering it, and they since have added it to the menu. So they've kind of had to compete a little bit.
A little perfunctory. Well, so I started with a strip. And I think I started with an Azelle's strip and was just basically I wanted to have one of the Azelle's pieces and one of the Heaven Sent pieces back to back, both the strips and then the fried chicken. And those were going to be the first four pieces of chicken that I ate.
Same. I did pretty much the same thing, although I might have had a couple of strips before I got to the fried chicken, but kept everything kind of isolated. And I had the rolls at the end.
And the first thing that struck me was obviously just how similar they are, right?
Yeah. Like,
they're very, very close, but I think there are slight differences.
I think they're even closer than Paseo and Un Bien, which is the previous. We did that one blind. We did not feel the need to do this one blind.
I think the thing that struck me was just how good the fried chicken is.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit, especially after the search, right? I was a little bit shocked. I mean, personally, I feel like I've been missing out for the last decade of not getting fried chicken when only getting strips. And like, I fucking love their strips. There's not a question about that. But I saw there was a take this week, and I think this was probably our perspective going to the search. I'm not saying this is fan service or whatever. I'm telling you right now, I think that the fried chicken at Azelle's and Heaven Sent is better than the strips.
I would not go that far.
I think they are on two completely different planes and categories. The meat inside of the Azelle's fried chicken is phenomenal. Like, it's something that after eating it, I was like, I've been missing this. But like, it was brined really perfectly. The flavor on the inside was excellent. Every single bite of the fried chicken was perfect. It's a different eating experience. Strips can dry out. That's the thing. That's the difference between the two, is that strips can get, I don't want to say stringy, but like fried chicken with the bones and how everything is condensed in there, it's a bigger piece. The chicken does, and this is not to compliment our parents or uncle or grandparents in the 1990s for getting food and eating it 4 hours later, because that shit was still dry as hell. But like a piece of fried chicken preserves a little bit longer than a chicken strip.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And I think in this scenario, if you, after this experience going in, I probably would have said, I want to eat the strips. I'm a little bit less concerned with the fried chicken. My whole perspective flipped after eating these, and I was stunned eating the Azelle's fried chicken and just how fucking good it was. So ended up in kind of a weird crossroads here, where to me, I think Azelle's was a hair ahead of Heaven Sent when it came to the fried chicken. And I think on the strips, I think Heaven Sent was maybe two hairs ahead of Azelle's. I think the strips were actually quite a bit better at Heaven Sent, but the fried chicken, bone-in fried chicken itself, I think Azelle's is the winner.
Interesting. I feel like I favored Heaven Sent by a hair in all of the pairings, and maybe more than a hair on the bun, where it was dramatically. I ate those at the end, so they might have both dried out considerably, but the Heaven Sent bun was way better and way fresher at that point. And I will say it probably was a slight advantage. I think I picked up my chicken at Heaven Sent after you picked up yours at Azelle's. It wasn't by a dramatic amount, but it was a little bit different.
Well, And mine may have been sitting for a little bit longer because I ordered it. It was at least 5-6 minutes before I picked it up where it was sitting there.
And
they don't have it heated while it's sitting there. It's in the box and it's in a bag, but it's not under like a heating light or anything.
You placed your order online. I called mine in and said it was going to be about 15 minutes, but still it wasn't like they immediately handed me the order when I paid. There was a couple minutes afterwards where they were still finishing the order. So I got it super fresh. So the Heaven
Sent was definitely a little bit fresher.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a freshness.
I think we are splitting hairs once I get the freshness because both were pretty fresh.
There's a lot of hair talk in this one for some reason. There was no hair in any of our chicken. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because what struck me about the fried chicken, trying that for the first time in probably at least 15 years, I would bet, is that it was it's so similar to the chicken strips. Like what I like about the strips was reflected in the fried chicken. So I think we need to get an order of fried chicken for the table at the very least when we go to Izell's in the future.
We are fucking up by not getting fried chicken at Izell's. I'm being straight up here. It is a mistake. If you're only getting chicken strips, unless you're getting them extraordinarily fresh, and that's what I'll say about Heaven Sent in particular, is like they don't make the chicken until you order it. Whereas Izell's, they're at least the Fairwood location, there's chicken sitting around for a while at various times.
But let's also remember with the chicken strip, the ability to take the bun and make a sandwich.
Oh, this is not anti-chicken strip. I'm just saying that the flavor in the chicken itself, inside of the chicken, I think is better on the fried chicken than it is in the chicken strip.
Okay, so do we have ratings for Heaven Sent and Izell's?
What was the rating? Okay, so there was the location in the Central District, right? Quick Pack Food Mart. I think this was better. I think that Heaven Sent, or I think actually both, and I think Izell's was better than Quick Pack Food Mart.
Interesting, because you gave Quick Pack a 91.
Oh, this is easily better than a 91.
Interesting.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give Izell's a 93 on the fried chicken. A 91 on the strips. Heaven Sent, a 92 on the fried chicken. And a 93 on the strips. I think overall, if you were to ask me, I could choose one or the other, and that's it. I probably would choose Heaven Sent, but it's extraordinarily close.
It's probably closer than I thought going in, I would say, because of that Fairwood experience. I mean, the other thing we should say is just like Izell's is very much, we should be clear, like the dicks of this competition. When we have the fan vote, if we have a live show, if you ever manage to get that scheduled, then Izell's is going to win.
September 18th, let's go.
Not September 17th, which was the date you were previously saving. Now save September 18th instead, one day later.
Come see Death Cab for Cutie in Napa Valley with me, September 17th.
So I don't think that they're going to win the competition. I don't think it's Seattle's best fried chicken, but in terms of like accessibility and just ubiquity and value and all of those elements, like you just can't go wrong with Izell's and Heaven Sent, assuming it's the flagship Izell's.
I don't really know what to do here with them. Like if we're moving to a bracket stage, are we moving Heaven Sent through?
Yeah, I mean, we both agreed that they're the stronger competitor.
Man. We can't have both, I don't think.
Probably does not make sense to have both, no.
Okay. All right. You felt stronger about this than I did. I'm pretty close on I'm pretty much even on both. So if you feel stronger on one of the two locations, then we can move through Heaven Sent to the bracket round.
I think that's
15 different.
Yeah, we're going to do a full 4-round bracket at this point. I don't know how we're going to do this in the 3 months remaining before September 18th, but somehow we'll figure out a way to pull it off. We're running low on locations, though. We're getting to the end of it.
There's probably still so much more fried chicken out there.
I mean, yes, but we're running low on locations that like we knew that we absolutely had to get to. And these were two of the big ones. Obviously, June Baby remains out there. I think it's supposed to be rainy this Sunday, so I don't know if we could do June Baby.
Is this the last week? Well, give us the news about June Baby.
It's news primarily about the sister restaurant Solare, but yes, as we transition into our local food update, Eduardo Jordan announced today, earlier on Tuesday, the closure of Solare, the first restaurant that he opened in 2015. Last day of service will be July 3rd for Solare, which served as a community kitchen as part of the restaurant workers relief program last spring before moving to a takeout model during the pandemic, but just too tough to survive. However, June Baby will continue to operate down the street and is resuming indoor dining next week.
Is that going to be indoor dining plus takeout or only indoor dining?
I'll have to look into that. So yes, I guess your point is if we want to try to do takeout or do we want to try to do takeout? Do we want to try to eat there?
All I've known about June Baby is how difficult it is to get the fried chicken is that you have to. And so like, are we going to not be able to get the fried chicken otherwise?
I mean, I think we're just going to have to be willing to wait. So
but no, it's not about waiting. It's that they run out of fried chicken. Like the situation is that pre-COVID, the situation for June Baby Fried Chicken was you need to go in for happy hour, be there early enough to be there for happy hour, hanging out. And then once it flips over to the chicken being available, then you order the fried chicken. But if you're not there at that time, you're not going to get it.
I'm not familiar with this element of it. So maybe
like this is all that I talked about pre-COVID.
You talked about going. I don't remember you explaining this complicated
sneak. The whole fucking
sneak.
Yes. That's literally everything that I talked about. It was, is anybody paying attention to this thing that's going on? Spreading the shelves in Italy. I don't like this. Ow. But that was it. And then being like, can we go to June Baby and get some chicken? And you'd always be like, no, not this week.
I kept waiting for the perfect week, and then the perfect week never happened.
And then all of a sudden, they're going to freaking open up for indoor dining, and we'll never be in there. It'll probably be limited capacity. It'll be like four people. Have you seen how small a restaurant it is?
I have seen how small a restaurant it is. I mean, again, we're reopening fully on June 30th, so it's not that far away. Well, we can discuss that. I wanted to talk about a different chicken restaurant, which I went to in Portland, which was Mama Bird. That was my last Portland meal of the Blazers season. We'll eulogize the Blazers in a little bit here.
It's going to be a 2.5 hour podcast.
But Gabriel Pescuzzi of Top Chef Portland operates Mama Bird. So after watching, Giddy is the Top Chef stand that I now am. Wanted to make sure I checked this out. And I was, you know, a little bit iffy because it's not fried chicken. It's exclusively grilled chicken that they offer there.
Can you pronounce Gabriel? You mean Gabriel?
Did I say Gabriel? Gabriel Pescuzzi. There we go. Yeah. So I was a little like uncertain about, is this the place I want to eat my final meal in Portland of the season? But I went there after game 6 of the Blazers Nuggets series last Thursday, which tipped off at 5 p.m. So it was a post game meal unusually. And I was blown away by this. It was so, so flavorful, and everything in, I got the, I think it's the chef's special basically, which is you only get like a half of all of the pieces, like the various pieces, you know, it's like half a breast and half a wing and such. But you also got with that a choice between asparagus or the seasonal fruit, which in this case was grilled mango. And then I chose sweet potato as kind of the potato side that came with this curry yogurt sauce that was just incredible. I mean, it was very similar to like what you would see on Top Chef in terms of just packing so much flavor into what is kind of a relatively simple meal of grilled chicken, grilled sweet potato, which is not a concept I have thought of grilling sweet potato before that, and grilled mango. And yet every bite was so delicious.
It looked pretty incredible. I'm looking through Gabriel Pescuzzi's Instagram right now. I'm just like, I don't know if I would recommend that. It's not bad. There's also, he's wearing an Oregon hat at one point too. So
yeah, Oregon in the Timbers. There's not a lot of Blazers stuff, but a lot of Timbers stuff.
It's so. Notched down. Look, he likes the Portland team that we don't like, but he doesn't like the Portland team that we do like. But no, the picture that you posted on Instagram was just like, holy shit.
And it's funny because I was like worried when I first got the box of food as takeout. I was like, is this going to photograph well? Because it's kind of all thrown around in here. But then, you know, I moved the chicken a little bit to be more photogenic and it came out looking incredible. So I definitely will be back next year. I know you need to go to hit it up the next time that you go down to Portland. Mrs. Fantasy Genius seemed pretty excited about going.
I will be there.
Well, I look forward to your review. Should we talk about the end of the Blazers season?
Sure. Now,
unfortunately, the Blazers did not win out as you predicted last week on the pod.
God damn it.
I believe we recorded after game four between 4 and 5, right?
That wasn't labeled victory lap.
Oh,
I was on my high horse.
It was more about the time that you said that Sue Bird will never play basketball again. And then she came back and led the Storm to a championship.
You know what? At least I'm out here offering takes.
Are you saying that I'm like on the fence about things?
Yeah, there's no, you give the updates and I'm out here to give the takes. You're saying matter-of-fact information.
Sue Bird probably still the best point guard in the WNBA this season at age 40. Just never question Sue Bird. That's my take.
When the Nuggets won the game, you were like, well, it is guaranteed that there will be at least a game 6. That was you. I don't know, whatever. But like, that's all that you offer. It's matter of fact information. Some of us are out here being bold. And
all right.
It was fine. Like, I mean, I think the reality is, as you've pointed out numerous times, the difference in NBA games is, do you hit threes or don't you hit threes? And the Blazers hit threes in the first half, and then they didn't hit threes in the second half of game 6. That was the reality. Like, and that's kind of what it boils down to. I know that people want to parse it more, but like, the team that shoots threes better, if Austin fucking Rivers gets hot, then you're going to win, right? Like, that's kind of there. I don't know if there's that much more to it in these games. And I understand that Jokic is a unique player and does a lot as far as like running the offense through Jokic. And I'm fine with Jokic when the Blazers are not competing against him. They've happened to have played against Jokic multiple times in the playoffs, so my feelings about him are a little bit clouded. But otherwise, I think it's fine. But like, part of the reason they lost the series was because Austin Rivers hit a bunch of shots. Like, I mean, I don't know if there's that much more to it, is that the Blazers managed to miss a few shots and Austin Rivers hit threes, and that's it. Like, I don't know.
There's a couple other things. Nurkic's foul trouble was an issue for them in the series. Like,
oh, that's the part of why had it out for Nurkic from the very beginning of the series.
That's part of why you felt good at halftime of game 6, is the Blazers are up 9. Nurkic at that point has no fouls. There was a conversation in our NBA chat about what are the odds Nurkic fouls out. And lo and behold, he did not, I don't think, but picked up 4 in the third quarter.
I wasn't born yesterday. I know what these refs are doing to Nurkic. And like, the amount of fouls that they're willing to call on Nurkic and the fouls that they're willing to call on Jokic are not comparable. So.
And then the other thing that happened is Dame, after his incandescent game 5 that the Blazers wasted in part because Nurkic fouled out of that game, and just nobody else could do anything offensively in the extra sessions other than Dame, he clearly ran out of gas in the second half of game 6. He didn't get his usual rest to start the fourth quarter because Denver had made a run to cut it down to, I think that was the Monte Morris half court.
I saw fucking Monte Morris in game 1 of the next round series, right?
Go 1 of 11, right?
And I'm like, bruh, like, is anybody else seeing this? He hits a running in 3. Like, there were a few flashpoint moments that if you look at them, and if those moments would have changed, at least there would have been a game 7. And then who knows?
I think they would have been able to rest Dame if it had still been 6. Maybe they wouldn't have, but the fact that it was down to 3 made it that much harder to rest Dame, and then he just completely ran out of gas in the fourth quarter.
It's just like, there's so much panic that happens after a season. Well, let's talk. We don't need to talk about the series anymore, but let's talk about the Blazers the second after the series ended.
It was a little more than the second, but not much more, that they mutually parted ways.
The press conference happened, the Dame press conference, and it was over.
The Dame, yes, the post-game comments. I mean, look, we all knew it was over. Like, we've known it was over unless they got...
You prepped me for this for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the worst kept secret in the league is that the if the Blazers didn't make a very long playoff run, that Terry Stotts was going to be out as head coach, which after 9 seasons in Portland, it's amazing that I've been covering the Blazers for, this was the 13th season, and there's only been 2 head coaches that entire time, Nate McMillan and Terry Stotts, other than Caleb Canales' brief run as interim coach after Nate McMillan was fired. It's incredible consistency.
Did Neil Olshey fire Nate McMillan?
No, he came in right after that season and hired Stotts.
He's already this close to getting on the list, but if he would have fired Mag 10.
That was that Rich Cho's decision? That might have been Rich Cho's decision. I mean, you know,
he's working out for Rich right now.
Well, you know, he's working in Memphis.
He's in Memphis now. I like Rich Cho, but
yeah, I think
Nate McMillan has proven in the end that he is an excellent head coach.
He has. I don't think it was the front office's. It wasn't the same thing of like the front office throwing Nate McMillan under the bus. It was more like the entire team decided to quit on Nate McMillan that season, including some very popular players who were quite fond of, decided to we're not so good to Nate McMillan that season, but that's neither here nor there. He's in a better place now. 8 playoff appearances in 9 seasons for Terry Stotts, including the Blazers' first series win and first trip to the conference finals since 2000 under his watch. And then Neil Olshey delivers a press conference, Blazers GM, on Monday talking about the season and says this first round loss was not a product of the roster, and also that this was not a roster that should have finished 29th in defense, even though it was a mutual parting. It could not have been any more clear that Neil Olshey was blaming the coaching for the reason the team had fallen short.
It's such fucking bullshit. And like, I sort of go back and forth between my perspective about the roster is that I don't think that this was a bad roster. I think that the Blazers by the end of the season had a pretty good roster. They just were, again, they missed some shots or whatever, right? But also at the same time, the defense was, they're bad at defense, right? Both of the perimeter guards are not that great of defenders. And then you have Cantor and Carmelo playing. Like when Nurk is not on the court, if the refs are going to foul Nurk out, there's so much pressure put on him, especially playing against a team with Jokic. It's too much pressure to put on one player. And like, I think there are good things that Neil Olshey did. I think the Norm Powell acquisition was a good acquisition. The trade for Robert Covington, like I don't think Neil Olshey did a bad job assembling the roster, but to say that this is not on the roster, it doesn't make him look good. That's the thing. It's like, sometimes when you're trying to deflect blame, it's like Terry Stotts is already gone, dude. You know what I mean? Like you can't, just putting it on him, it doesn't really matter anymore. Terry Stotts has already been fired. And we know where this is going. If we're looking at it long term, it might be Dame next, which we'll talk about in a second. And it's going to be Neil Olshey after that. Like the chances right now that Neil Olshey is the GM of the Blazers in 3 years are probably quite low. And this comment does not help him out. It doesn't make him look better in this situation. Sometimes accepting blame is a good thing. In fact, not sometimes, almost all the time, accepting blame is a good thing, or at least being clear about the situation. But just saying this is not a product of the roster, it's an offensive thing to say, and it's offensive to Terry Stotts' seasons as the head coach, which we'll look back on if in the future we're Blazers fans, because that may change. But like, Terry Stotts will be looked back on as one of the best coaches in Blazers history.
Second in franchise history in wins.
Going to the playoffs is still the goal. That's the thing. It's like the team consistently overachieved under Terry Stotts. You had them left for dead over and over and over again. Not just you, but every basically like NBA analyst, all projections, they consistently exceeded those projections. Like this could have been a team during this time period with Terry as the head coach, they could have bottomed out, right? There were a lot of opportunities where it could have all fallen apart and Terry Stotts held it together. And the thing about Neil Olshey is he's resting a lot of laurels. Did he draft Dame, by the way?
He did, yes.
He's resting a lot of laurels, John Schneider, like on some things that happened a long time ago. And since then, he has not drafted a contributor especially in the first round in many years. Phenomenal draft picks with Dame and CJ, But beyond that, I think the Nurk trade was great, and there have been good individual acquisitions. But like, there's still a bit of a void of talent on this team, especially on the defensive end. But like, the bust on the Zach Collins pick, whether it's injuries or not, missing on that pick is freaking huge. Putting so much stock in Anfernee Simons developing into, you know, like the amount of hype that was around Anfernee Simons was just off.
And where was that hype coming from?
From Neil Olshay, right?
Not just him. I mean, the other Blazers players as well, but yes.
But like, the reality is we know where this is headed right now. And there's, because of this move that happened and scapegoating Terry Stotts, look, Neil Olshay held on to his job for a couple more years, but like, the Blazers are right on the precipice of a rebuild. And Dame Lillard probably will not be a Blazer in 2 years. CJ McCollum may not be a Blazer next year. I don't know. But like, this roster isn't set up to win a championship. On the flip side, I think that people aren't recognizing that winning a championship isn't necessarily it. Like, we're living here in a fucking society. Democracy is crumbling around us. Like, everything that we know to be true is all wrong. Billionaires don't pay fucking taxes. Trillionaires don't pay taxes. And we're concerned that the Blazers aren't going to win the championship when we could just enjoy that they're going to the playoffs every year. We have seen a team that is in just mediocrity, can't quite make the playoffs. It's not fun. Having Dame Lillard, having a team like this is actually fun. And I don't think people are recognizing that going to the playoffs every single year, 8 out of the 9 years, having a chance, being in the mix, I don't think people are recognizing how important that is.
Well, I think the 2019 run to the conference finals fucked everything up because it made them think they were that close to winning a championship, and they weren't. Instead, they went the opposite direction after that, in part because of injuries. But they were never the second best team in the West. They just, you know, had a favorable draw and won a 7-game series against Denver.
Just like the Nuggets last year.
The Nuggets were different, though, because they were young enough and had enough around their star that, like, you know, a lot of people thought they were going to be the best team in the West after they traded for Aaron Gordon and before Jamal Murray got hurt. So maybe they'll end up in that situation long term, but they've also got many more years because Jokic is like 5 years younger than Dame Lillard. John Hollinger made the point in his piece for The Athletic, which was well pointed out, that Clyde Drexler was the exact same age when he got traded out of Portland in this kind of very similar situation as Dame will be next year. So but the other thing is, it's one thing for the fans to recognize that just being a quality team and making the playoffs is good enough. It's another thing for Damian Lillard to recognize that. And I think it's completely fair and reasonable for him to want more given the, you know, his ability as an individual talent.
I also don't blame Damian Lillard if he wants to play for a different team. Like, and maybe this is my perspective as somebody who's like an ersatz Blazers fan. Like, if Damian Lillard plays for another team, I'll just cheer for him on that team. I could cheer for the Blazers or not, right? Like, you know, I didn't grow up, I'm not seeing this team on a day-to-day basis. So like, maybe that's the perspective, but like, I think the idea that you should stay with one team and toil away in mediocrity or whatever, have to have 100% of the pressure on you all the time because they drafted you or whatever, is like, it's such a ridiculous notion of
it's a one-sided notion, because no one ever says, hey, the Blazers have to re-sign Zach Collins and stay loyal to him because they drafted him, which they probably will, but no one still says they have to.
Oh God. It still kind of funnels back to pro management too. You know, like, if Damian Lillard wants to play somewhere else, then play somewhere else, which I guess leads to the question of, what's next for this Blazers roster? What can they do? CJ is somebody who people have circled as they need to find a trade partner for CJ. I think that the general populace has a really hard time seeing a team with two guards. But also, is Damian Lillard a question now?
Probably not, but we'll see how the coaching search went. I mean, I think it would have been more pressure on the Blazers. Like, he came out very publicly on Friday night and said he wanted Jason Kidd to be the coach And then Kidd later withdrew from consideration. It's unclear to what extent Kidd's history of domestic abuse was a factor in that and would have been a challenge to him becoming the Blazers head coach. But, you know, if he doesn't like the direction that they go at head coach, I think that could potentially precipitate a change. And certainly, you know, just his tone has been very different, you know, this past week here than it was leading up to it, where, you know, he was just consistently talking about how much he wanted to get it done in Portland. So I don't think it's probably going to be this offseason. I think it's give a new coach a chance. And if that doesn't work, then that's the next change.
So do you think they run it back with a similar roster with the new coach?
Probably, just because of the difficulty of making anything. I mean, there's not a clear CJ McCollum trade out there. Now, you know, maybe something comes up and something surprises us, but they don't have a lot of financial flexibility. They're, you know, already basically close to the cap with the extensions for Lillard and CJ McCollum kicking in this year, which is, you know, the Supermax extension for Dame. And it's not a Supermax for McCollum, but a raise on what he was making previously. And with the cap staying relatively flat, it's going to increase more than that. And then you've got to try to re-sign Norman Powell as an unrestricted free agent and potentially Zach Collins as a restricted free agent. So, you know, we'll see how much that leaves left, but probably you're checking out the taxpayer mid level.
Good riddance to Zach Collins.
I think Zach Collins will be returning given the history of how the Blazers have handled their restricted free agents that they drafted.
Fine. Bring Norm back though.
I think he probably will come back. It'd be surprised. It's kind of what John Hollinger has termed the bird rights trap, where you don't get the whole cap space to replace this guy if they go somewhere else. You basically have to replace them using your mid-level exception. And especially in a diminished free agency, it's going to be tough to get someone starter caliber with that.
How concerned do you think the Blazers are going to be about the tax?
They've been willing to pay the tax for a contender. Now, whether ownership believes they can be a contender, that faith is probably a little shaken as compared to where it was 2 years ago when they paid the tax.
Okay, if we can percentage chance this Peltoncast style, percentage chances that CJ McCollum is on the team next season?
85.
Do you think that's more about that there isn't a good trade partner out there or because they want to keep CJ?
I think they value CJ a lot, and that makes it hard to find that right trade partner.
I mean, I love CJ. Like, I personally think, I think they might as well just run it back and see what happens with the new head coach. But percentage chances that Dame Lillard is on the team next year?
90. To start the season? Yeah, 90.
To start the season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it could happen quickly during the season. Drexler was traded midseason. James Harden. Not that I think that Dame is going to be doing anything similar to James Harden in Houston this past year.
Pretty unique situation.
But it was a similar situation in terms of, you know, everyone was kind of like, hey, let's keep an eye on James Harden long term. Who knows whether the Rockets are going to be able to figure things out. This might be as good as they're going to get. And then it went from 0 to 60 in a heartbeat. And the coaching search was probably a factor in that.
How much of a factor do you think the basically the relationship with Tillman Fertitta was also, though?
I don't think that specifically was a factor. I think it was probably him and Westbrook breaking up was a factor.
He wanted to stay with Westbrook.
Just like the two of them realizing it wasn't going to work together.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll see. Do you think there's a trade partner for Dame?
If they are going to trade Dame, the logical team, I think, is Philadelphia, which, you know, is in the mix for Harden. Has Ben Simmons, who could come back, and you're not talking about a rebuild if you're the Blazers. They're willing, you know, and we'll see what happens to the Sixers.
Daryl Morey trade ever.
We'll see what happens to the Sixers. They're also, you know, they could win the championship this year, and then maybe they're not talking about making a move like that. But it seems like a logical fit if that's not the case.
But you know that Daryl will do whatever it takes to get a superstar.
And is willing to be very aggressive trying to win now. So
what does that do? Let's say that a swap happens of some kind, a Ben Simmons for Dame swap. Are the Blazers in rebuild mode then? Or what are they? I don't know that much about Ben Simmons aside from that he can't shoot.
I mean, he's an all-star caliber player. He's not Damian Lillard. Like, you're probably in the play-in, that range. So you'd probably trade Robert Covington, I think, at that point, given his age and his value to other teams as a role player. But I don't think you're talking about a full teardown or anything.
Do you think there's a chance for Ben Simmons to grow as a player and really lead a team on his own?
There's a chance for it. I mean, I think you could maybe build around him, because the Sixers aren't built around his skills. They're built around Joel Embiid. So it'd be different if he was the guy. But that's all like very hypothetical and distantly in the future.
Okay. I don't think it just watching Dame Lillard in that series, it just didn't. This is the final thought on the Blazers. He's, after Kempin Payton, the most exciting basketball player I've ever seen in my entire life.
Wow. Wow. Did Brandon Roy never exist?
Brandon Roy doesn't do shit that Dame Lillard does. I'm sorry, but like, you know, that's true, right? Just watching basketball as a sport and seeing people do these incredible feats of humanity, like, that is what Dame Lillard does.
He's reached a level that Brandon Roy unfortunately was never able to get to because of his injuries.
Mostly for players that I've paid close attention to.
You know, there's like three times in NBA history that a guy has made 10 three-pointers in a playoff game, and two of them are Damian Lillard. Like, that's so incredible.
I want to see Dame Lillard play on a really good team. I want to see him be the star on a really good team, because I don't like the idea of him sort of being like pushed to the back burner. But like, if there was a really good roster put around Dame Lillard, I think it would be very exciting for what he could do. And he's like, he's willing to take shots, but he's also willing to distribute, you know, like his skill set. Dame Lillard is just a fucking incredible basketball player. I think he is underrated as a basketball player.
I think based on his finish in MVP voting, he was somewhat underrated.
Where did he finish?
I think he was like sixth.
He didn't put the team on his back. He put the whole goddamn city of Portland on his back.
Wow. Ugh. Well,
love you,
with that, you've Lock delivered. Love you've you delivered. You've lived up to your promise to deliver some takes, and now it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
So, Jared Kelenic was sent down this week after less than a month and hitting under 100 for the Mariners, and. You know who I blame for this whole situation?
Who's that?
Me.
Oh, no.
After 20 fucking years, I should have known better. The Mariners cannot have a good prospect. That's not how these things work for them. Like when Kanye said, when you see close, close your eyelids. For the Mariners, it's when you see Baseball America prospect rankings, close your eyelids. These prospect rankings should be considered as volatile as GameStop stock, or better yet, just add 100 to the ranking, because that's how the player is going to pan out when they play in the majors. Joe Manchin is more likely to overturn the filibuster than the Mariners are to develop a successful young prospect. And meanwhile, we're out here marching along, grabbing our Lil Woody's burgers and our Din Dam Tai Fung, and we never see it coming. Just stunned 20 straight years in a row. So anyway, I hope that you were paying close attention during that Kraken segment, because you want a bold prediction? That is a team that is going to make the playoffs before the Mariners ever do.
I don't know if that's a hot take or not, but I like it. I mean, the Mariners did develop Felix Hernandez during the past two decades. So sometimes the Mariners' way is to have an amazingly great player and just surround them with so little that that player never goes to the playoffs in their entire career.
One player.
It has happened, and not with a hitter, it's in fairness. Yeah, a 39 at-bat hitless streak for Jared Kelenic before he returned to AAA Tacoma. That whole thing about like, oh, they were just making up that he needed more seasoning in the minors. Maybe they actually knew what they were talking. I don't know. Maybe
the worst part about this is that the Mariners were right. Like, the organization of the Mariners doing something or in hindsight, having something that was correct, it hurts even more.
You said we had a quick coach's corner this week. Well, we're on the baseball topic.
Well, this is a very quick coach's corner, but the baseball season is coming to an end for Baby Fantasy Genius this week, which he's very sad about. There's a chance of him playing on a select team, which has three fucking practices a week and a game. And I'm like, I don't know if I see myself committing to that type of situation. Anyway.
I mean, you're going to end up coaching.
That's not what this coach's corner is about, because Mrs. Fantasy Genius received a text message last weekend from his coach, which said, for this last practice, we're going to mix things up. We're going to have a little bit of fun here. And the parents are going to get to play along with the kids at practice. We're going to do a simulated game. And she was like, do you want to do that? And I was like,
if there's one thing I know about you that I've learned during your lifetime, your 36 years on this earth, it's that you love playing as an adult against little kids.
Every practice I go to, I bring my glove and I sit in the car with my glove. I'm like, put me in, coach. I'm ready to play. So I just wait for the coach to look over and be like, you in the Honda Odyssey. Yeah, come on, get out here. So finally, the chance to play a semi-competitive baseball game against you. If only you were out there, you should just come to practice.
Why not?
I'd be like, ESPN's Kevin Pelton is up. He's retired from basketball, but he's still cracking dingers at baseball.
Also retired from competitive softball.
Wow. You're going to retire from one sport each week on the podcast next week?
I went out on top, four consecutive championships with the Storm softball team.
Really?
Three. I guess maybe only three. I think 2010 was our first championship.
It was when they stopped letting me play.
Yes.
So anyway, I'm famous for never having won a recreational sporting event, but we'll see. I don't know if this counts as a recreational sporting event.
Is it adults against the kids?
No, they're going to mix it up. They're going to split up the teams, kids and adults. But like Luca's been so, we told him about this on Sunday and he was just like, he'll wake up every morning and be like, I dreamed about that practice again last night.
which day is it?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
He literally has spent his entire life preparing for this moment to have adults playing. Because it's like kids playing against each other at baseball, that's fine. But his favorite thing on earth is playing competitive sports against adults.
And vice versa. Well, I mean, next week's Coach's Corner is going to be a classic when we describe, recap of this.
How I do it. I'm going to knock on wood when I say this. Throw my shoulder out of the socket the first time I swing.
Has been known to happen in recreational sporting events.
I feel like that's my dad crying on the ground in pain.
Oh no. All right, not a lot of soccer news this week as the Sounders were off for the international break. Brad Smith is returning to the team after suffering what was termed a, quote, minor injury in training camp with the Australian Socceroos national team.
Hello.
Well, Rain did play last weekend, a 1-0 loss at Gotham FC. Ifeoma Onomano scored the lone goal for Gotham FC. Rain had 18 shots, including 6 on goal, all saved by Gotham keeper Didi. Rose Lavelle went the full 90 in her second match for the Rain and had 2 of those shots on goal. Seattle Storm, as we mentioned earlier, 2-1 last week, beat Indiana by 15 in Noel Quinn's debut as head coach. Then two thrilling games against the Dallas Wings, the much improved Dallas Wings, getting that 105-102 overtime win on Friday and then losing 68-67 in the game I attended, with Arike Ogunbowale hitting a back-to-back threes in the final minute of that one, including the go-ahead three in the final second. So the game Friday, as I mentioned, Jule had knocked down her second career game-winning three-pointer at the buzzer. Previously did that last year against Los Angeles in the Wubble. Joined Elena Delodon, Sophia Young-Malcolm, and Shavante Zelis, former Storm player, as the fourth player in WNBA history with multiple game-winning buzzer beaters, according to Elias Sports Bureau. I had them ask about this. I went into the sports and stats and information group chat that we have at ESPN because I was thinking, like, well, there can't be that many other players that had game-winning buzzer beaters the last couple of years, right? She's got to be like one of a couple, and found out that there was this many in the entire 25-year history of the WNBA.
How much time do you spend in the stats and information group chat?
Not that much time.
Not as much as I think. They're never just like, God damn it, Kevin Pelton has a question again.
Well, you know, if I have a question, it means that I can't answer it in another way. So it's probably a good one.
I see. It's pure condescension. Got it.
Didn't say it that way. It's like, hey, I'm pretty self-sufficient. So when I need your help, that means that it's going to be a tough one. And they're always up to the task is the key.
They're the real winners.
So the Storm with the final shot on Sunday with less than a second left. It was 0.8 seconds left on Friday, 0.7 on Sunday. Instead of going to Lloyd, this time a direct entry to Brianna Stewart in the post where she missed at the buzzer. But Jewel Lloyd made it clear afterwards she could live with Stewie getting that shot. It was a quality look for the Storm, who now had it on the road. They played the Wings. Wednesday, they'll start this road trip at Atlanta. It's a pair of games against the Dream Wednesday and Friday. Then Saturday, they play against Connecticut, the other top team in the WNBA. But the Sun will be without MVP favorite Jonquel Jones, who's playing in Eurobasket right now. So an opportunity for the Storm to get a second win against the Sun this season in their final matchup. And then they finish that road trip at Indiana, including next Tuesday. So let's wrap up by talking about the Seahawks, who did not trade for Julio Jones. Sadly, you kind of called it correctly that the Falcons were not going to get a first round pick for Julio, who went to the Tennessee Titans for a 2022 second round pick and a swap of day three picks in 2023. Tennessee sending a fourth round pick in 2023 for Atlanta's sixth round pick. But I was right, despite being disproven on Twitter by, I think was that Zach Jabal who pointed that out, that both the Percy Harvin and Jimmy Graham trades were in-conference trades. But in this case, the Falcons sent Julio to the opposite conference.
I think the conference was maybe a little bit less important here rather than the familiarity between the teams right now. And there was a lot of smoke around the Titans, and they made it happen. Obviously, they were able to do it cap-wise. You know, I think the Seahawks would have been able to make this trade. And I think they could have done precisely the same compensation as the Titans made in this trade. I wouldn't be surprised if the Falcons were like, here's the deal. It's a second and a six, or it's a, yeah, second and a six, and you get Julio and a fourth back. It's a pretty good trade, right?
Second and a fourth.
Julio and a six. For Julio and a six. Like, it's a pretty good trade, I think, on... Oh, yeah. The value that you're getting is the other team, but like they were going to, if the options were to do the exact same trade with the Seahawks or whomever else, right, they were just going to choose the Titans because of, again, that familiarity. And maybe the conference was part of it. You know, the Seahawks would have had to have beaten it, I guess, is what the deal is. And they weren't going to give up a first here for Julio, which for better or worse, maybe they should have been willing to give up first, but they already invested those resources in Jamal Adams. And if they hadn't done that, I think if Jamal Adams is not traded to the Seahawks, again, we have no idea what the fuck happens last season without Jamal Adams. I think if the Seahawks had not traded for Jamal Adams, that Julio Jones is a Seahawk.
It certainly seems a lot more likely in that scenario. I mean, it's not surprising that they didn't get him. I put the odds at 5% last week. But it is kind of a disappointment given that the price was this low, even if they would have had to beat it, as you say.
But again, like, I mean, are they not going to have a first round pick 3 years in a row? And like, it probably would have taken.
The LA Rams say challenge accepted.
But I think they probably would have, if they would have sent a first round pick to the Falcons, I think Julio Jones again would be a Seahawk. But it would have taken, you know, they would have not had a first round pick 3 years in a row, which was not something the Seahawks were comfortable with. And that's a pretty big investment. You know, I don't think they felt great about not having a first round pick this year, as much as they wanted to say that Jamal Adams was their first round pick. Like, it really does affect how much you can do in the draft by not having that first round pick. You know, it really hamstrings you. with regards to the flexibility that you have in the draft. So I get it. I understand it from that perspective. I don't know if I think it's right necessarily, because Julio Jones is a unique level talent. And who knows, maybe if it was a second and a third, maybe they could have gotten it done. But they didn't trade for Julio Jones, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like hugely upset about it. I think it probably would have been a good move for them if they made it, but you know, it's not the end of the world that they didn't. They do now have to face Julio Jones in week two of the season when Tennessee comes to town. So that'll be interesting.
I think that Tennessee team is pretty scary.
Certainly that offense is scary. I mean, it was already a very good offense, and then they added Julio Jones.
In fact, I will say, I think that the Titans are the favorites to win the Super Bowl right now.
Wow. The favorites.
Maybe that's too far. I don't know. I think the Titans or the Chiefs, whoever wins that AFC, I think are the favorites to win the Super Bowl.
Those two teams are playing this year as well. That'll be a very interesting matchup in Tennessee. So,
but it's a bummer. I mean, like, to know that you could have gotten Julio Jones, it just feels like the Seahawks are kind of, they're just kind of bad at this, except for the Jadeveon Clowney trade. They're not great at getting players.
Dwayne Brown.
I still don't think they got that much value for Dwayne Brown. I'm sorry, but like, they traded a second round pick for a 30 plus year old tackle who was getting paid. Yeah, Julio Jones.
But that 30 year old tackle was like holding their offensive line together by a thread the last few years. So.
I guess so. I don't see them getting value for Dwayne Brown. I think they paid market rate for Dwayne Brown.
Yeah, I don't think they read the market perfectly, but he was a player they desperately needed, is I guess what I'm saying here.
Oh, and I guess every team desperately needs Dwayne Brown. But like,
no, especially a team that had not really much else going on at left tackle. Because the guy who they converted from playing basketball was injured in training camp.
Oh, God. If he'd never gotten hurt, all of history is different. But I think the Seahawks are really bad at reading value for these particular situations. Clowney is kind of the only time that they did it. And I think there's no consistent team that has just like swindled people. Like, you come back to the Mohamed Sanu trade. Mohamed Sanu basically got traded for the same that Julio Jones got traded for. And obviously there's a pretty big discrepancy in the talent there. There've been a lot of extraordinarily average wide receivers who've been traded for about the same value as Julio Jones. So, but
some below average ones have been traded for more than Julio Jones.
Well, we're going back to Deion Branch again.
Oh no. Oh, we were so excited for that first week.
But I wish that the Seahawks were able to assess value a little bit better in these situations. But like, the reality is, to go get players in the NFL, you most of the time have to overpay. That you can't really sit back and just wait for DeAndre Hopkins and Julio Jones to come into your lap. But they also have not gotten Julio Jones or DeAndre Hopkins. So
it is indeed true.
And I think it's a little frustrating how they view things and how they assign value to players and draft picks, and that they haven't been able to go and make any of those moves. But again, 30 other teams haven't either.
Correct.
So
veteran players rejoined OTAs this week, led by Russell Wilson. But I don't know if there's too much to say about this. I don't think it's a huge deal either way. Well,
those are the kind of takes that you offer. That's it. Russell Wilson is attending OTAs. I have no perspective on this, positive or negative.
Russell Wilson attending OTAs is a sign that he will be a Seattle Seahawk for life.
You're like, there's like a Futurama, like a neutral planet. That's you.
There's a neutral Janet in The Good Place. End of transmission. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.